My name is Bulldog, but you may remember me as John Drummond, okay? And you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Gold Ice House in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, tonight we have a special guest, came all the way from New York to Kansas City via the telephone lines and the internet lines and Skype and all those kinds of fancy things. I think you'll really enjoy some of his stories. We're going to be doing a whole month-long series on the New York mob because, you know, I usually do. I've done a lot of Chicago and done, of course, a heck of a lot of Kansas City and then Las Vegas. Those are kind of more in my wheelhouse, shall we say. So we're swinging out to New York, and this will be one of our four episodes that are strictly about the New York families. Say hello to everybody there. Ed Scarpo of Cosa Nostra News.
Hello, everybody.
Thanks, Ed. It's great to have you here. You know, I've been in contact with you a little bit off and on ever since the social media stuff, and I started doing this. I had my movie out, my documentary film, and I had my Gangland Wire Facebook page, and then I started looking for other people who were doing the same kind of thing and were blogging. I used to do a lot more written blogging than I do now. Now I write show notes and then attach it to the as my blog pieces rather than just writing a blog. You're a longtime blogger and a really good writer in the mob genre, shall we say. So it seemed like we got a hold of each other via Twitter a long time ago and had some conversation. And I've been intending on having you on the podcast, but I just, all of a sudden, it's like 3.5 or 3 years later, and I just got so wrapped up in Chicago and Las Vegas. And finally, I'm like,
yeah.
I got to get to New York. And so you're the first person I thought of because you are one of the experts on the New York families.
I really appreciate that, Gary. Thank you. I try to be, you know. I think I started around 2010, 2011, and it's 2018 already.
Really?
But I've actually been a journalist my career, so I approach it from the perspective of that.
Yeah, it's a darn good true crime writing. I'll affirm that. Do you have remind me, you know, I created an app called the Kansas City Mob Tour. Do you guys have a mob tour app in Manhattan or in New York?
There definitely was one. I don't know if it still exists or what happened.
Oh, okay.
But it was a few years ago, and I don't think so, though.
Okay, well, that's... they're pretty popular, although it's hard to make any money off of an app. That's the deal. You put a lot of money into it,
yeah.
And then it's people, they get so much for free anymore that they don't want to pay anything. So
they want you to update the app. And the best thing, one of the things about the podcast that's great has to be that, like, every time we talk to somebody, we'll talk about something and we didn't know, maybe an address. Like there in New York City, and it's like, man, well, that really needs to go into that app.
Yeah. Give us your social media contact information. People will want to follow you in.
Well, on Facebook, it's just Cosa Nostra News. I have a Facebook page. I got almost 20,000 followers or so, or likes, or whatever you call it. Twitter, I've got about 5,000 on Twitter. It's Ed Scarpo at Ed. But it's I use that as a Cosa Nostra News page too on Twitter. I usually post on Facebook, and I do it all automatically using a third party app, and it just puts you everywhere you want to go. Pinterest too, but I don't get a lot of activity from Pinterest. I don't really know how that works.
Did anybody ever tell you I'm looking here?
It's really free advertising, social media.
I'm looking here at your Ed Scarpo on Twitter, and you look a lot like a guy from The Sopranos.
Oh yeah, that's Frank Vincent. I don't.
You're a silver-haired fox there.
We don't know what he looks like. He's got to keep Ed has to keep a low profile. Yeah, he doesn't want anybody knowing what he looks like. I mean, he's writing about some bad characters there. And New York's a big city, but it's not that big, is it?
Yeah, it's not that big if you run into somebody, that's for sure.
I would. They'd see you and they want your autograph.
Yeah, they want your autograph. Only don't get in the car with them and let anybody sit behind you.
A beautiful woman approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was the back to the wall.
Well, but I would think that a lot of folks, you know, you report this stuff and not, you know, Gary and I were talking about this before the program. Not everybody wants to hear this stuff. They may not be happy with what you have to say.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that kind of have to experience it. You go through it and you realize that. I mean, at first I didn't even realize that. It's like you start a blog and you don't realize how many people are reading it, how many people are seeing it. Then you get some pushback and you don't know how to react. But I definitely understand. I'm a much, much more sensitive to that than I ever was in the past.
Yeah, I understand. I got onto that too. I mean, Kansas City is a small town, especially compared to New York, but I would do some podcasting or write some blog pieces about local people, and then I'd have their relatives getting on there and making caustic comments about how I didn't know what I was talking about and different things. Same way with my app. They were criticizing my app, and they didn't like it that I put on. And then I had one guy that at first I had this address in there, and some mob people, some of the grandchildren were still living in a house. And so this guy goes up and he gets out, following my app, he gets out and walks around the houses taking pictures. And then somebody comes out and confronts him. So I about had to duke it out right there. So I took that address out and I've been a little bit more careful, but I still get a comment every once in a while. I even had one guy tell me, he said, you ruffled some feathers up there. And I knew he was a guy that knew. So, it's just part of it, I think. I'm willing to take my chances. God, what would life be without taking a little chance every now and then?
Yeah, exactly. And there's just a little too much testosterone in the mafia sometimes, around the mafia anyway.
Yeah, well, Gary ought to try walking through my neighborhood. He could feel that rush all the time. I'm living in the mean streets of Kansas City in Midtown.
How long?
That was since 2001. I'm just a kid from South Dakota originally, so I moved here by way of Los Angeles.
Really?
You had this article that you published on Monday, January 15th. Folks can go back and read that. And there's, from the piece that Gary wrote here, there was 106 comments about Michael D. Leonardo.
Oh, Michael D. Leonardo, yeah. Mikey Scars, former Gambino crime family capo. I've known him for years, and he's a good guy. I mean, he lived an incredible life for a long time. This is a guy who said when he was 10 years old, his goal in life was to become a Gambino capo, not a doctor, not a pilot, 10 years old. It's incredible.
That is. I wanted to be a cowboy when I grew up. So
I wanted to be a baseball player.
Every week it changed with me. I mean, I wanted to be an archaeologist for a long time, though.
Because you thought you could get to travel to these far-off lands and have adventures, didn't you? I remember.
Yeah, I don't know. I had this thing with dinosaurs.
So you talked about a story about how did he get that nickname, Mikey Scars, and did everybody call him that?
Yeah, his nickname was known to be Mikey Scars. You see that in the newspapers and books, but like you say, Is that his, you know, is that what they called him in the mob, or is that the nickname that the newspapers invented for him, the you know, reporters? I was talking to him about that once, and he got the nickname because when he was a kid, he was attacked by a dog. You know, he didn't get carved up with a knife like Al Capone. I asked him once about the nickname, and he said, well, they didn't say it to my face. So I've always wondered if mob nicknames are something that's used when the person in question isn't in the room. In other words, they're talking about somebody, and they say, hey, Mikey Diners or whatever, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, I wonder how, when and how, the etiquette of using a mob nickname, so to speak.
Well, I was thinking...
You know, like Albert Anastasia.
Yeah, the Mad Hatter, and they gave him that nickname, Dad, because I think he wore different hats or something. He liked, you know, men always wore hats back then. That was probably the media that gave him that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering...
Exactly, and I think in the mob... They called him Don Umberto, that's all.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe they had their nicknames internally, and then, like, the police had one or the papers had one. I think of the wiretap material that Gary has from his book in the movie, but they did use the code words for the Shepherd and some of these other genius and use those nicknames when they were talking about them.
Yeah, like they had Lefty Rosenthal out in Las Vegas. They called him Newspaper because he was always wanting to get in the media. And they called another guy Channel because he was a channel to some people on the gaming control board. They called another guy Pecoradu because that's Sicilian for Shepherd. And his name was Shepherd. So, you know, there's always some kind of basis for the nickname, but getting to it is always interesting. It never is apparent on the surface.
Yeah, sometimes they get it wrong. Like the public and the newspapers, they print the nickname, they know somebody's nickname, and they print it, but they, you know, they pontificate on where it came from, and it turns out they're wrong. Like Angelo Quack Quack Ruggiero, he had the nickname because he talked too much, and supposedly he got that nickname because of the way he walked. I don't know how you can walk, and they call it a quack, but
he probably walked like a duck.
Maybe he walked too much.
I bet he walked like a duck. I've seen people walk kind of like a duck.
Oh, he talked too much.
Talked too much, yeah, could be. You know what they say, Anthony Accardo said, a fish that keeps his mouth closed never gets caught. So,
is that why they called him?
They never hook him. You can't hook him.
They called him the big tuna?
The big tuna because he hooked a fish once.
I thought because he always had the tuna melt.
He always had the tuna melt. No, I don't think so, Aaron. Next time we see Anthony Accardo, oh, he's dead. I want you to say, they call you the big tuna because you always have the tuna melt.
Well, I mean.
Down at Denny's.
Somebody's got to ask the question. Why can't it could be me. I'm generally the stupidest here, so I would have to play along with the part. No, if I was Ed Scarpo.
Now tell us.
I knew Mikey Scar.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about Mikey's young adulthood and his first how did he get straightened out, shall we say?
He, you know, he fell in with the family during the reign of John Gotti, and he was actually made on Christmas Eve, 1988, with John Jr. Gotti. John Gotti was boss out on the street, but he stayed away from the ceremony because he didn't want to create an appearance of nepotism. So actually, Sammy Gravano conducted the ceremony with Mikey Scars, John Jr., and a few other guys. Michael said that he did very well under John. He got promoted to capo. What happened was when Sammy the Bull flipped, you don't think about this, the public doesn't think about this, but when a guy like Sammy the Bull flips, and he, you know, basically puts a whole generation of mobsters away, that creates huge opportunities for guys still in the mob. That's how Michael got, you know, he was elevated after, because Sammy the Bull took all these guys out and, you know, they went, if he didn't kill him, he put them in prison. And that's how Michael became capo. But, you know, I've talked to him a lot. I've written a lot of stories about him. And, I mean, he really experienced firsthand the the utter treachery, how brutal. I mean, people forget that. It's not glamorous. It's really not about oaths. It's not about honor. These guys aren't principled. It's steal as much money as you can, kill everyone. I'm kind of babbling a little, it's just a very brutal life. Here's a guy who was born to be in the mafia. His grandfather was part of Salvatore D'Aquila, one of the first bosses in Manhattan, New York City. This was a guy who was born into the mafia and he's the last guy who would have testified. But he was in a position where he was in jail and the family just basically shelved him, took all his money, and he felt betrayed. And, he did some things. You know, he made decisions when he wasn't in the greatest state of mind, as he says. But I know he regrets a lot of what happened. It's difficult, you know.
Well, that's not the first time I've heard somebody say that, though.
I prefer writing about it than living it.
I think that, you know, there's been other instances of folks that we've spoken to that have said they, you know, their family, they, you know, got the sense that they were going to be taken care of if something happened, they had to go to the slammer. And then they go to the slammer and their family's not taken care of.
Yeah.
So what
it's
was
crazy when you think about it. I mean,
What was Mikey Scars? What kind of an earner was he? How did did he have any kind of specialty that he participated in to earn money? Because you got to be an earner. You got to make money for these guys if you're gonna, especially if you're going up.
Yeah, a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, people. Some people think I think some people think when you join the mafia, get made, they pay you. You don't get any money. You have to give them money.
Yeah, really. I know.
Michael was in the construction business. He ran part of that for the Gambinos in New York. He basically took over what Sammy the Bull was doing before he flipped. And he made a lot of money. I don't know the specific details of that. Anything that's not in the papers or in the books or wherever. But construction is controlling the unions, who gets what jobs. It's bid rigging. It's so many different levels to it.
Yeah, so they can get cash money kickbacks from if he's got control of the union, construction unions, he can get cash money kickbacks from businessmen who want to keep their union problems down. He can get really lucrative contracts for certain unions, and somebody will kick him back under the table. That's always going to be a series of kickbacks in the construction business for a variety of different things. Provide no-show jobs. That's a famous Sopranos episode or two where these guys get these they didn't have no-show jobs, they had no work jobs, and they'd have a scene where they'd be out on a construction site and they're all just sitting around, you know, shooting the breeze while all the regular union guys are working,
fanning themselves.
Yeah.
The no-show is definitely better than a no-work, but one, I guess, is better than having to go and work.
Having a steady paycheck coming in without any risk, you know, you don't have to go out and hold a gun on somebody and take the chance of having some off-duty policeman walk up or to go out and extort money from some loan shark victim and have them turn around and testify against you. That would be a lot better than the no work construction job. So he probably went into the Raven Eyed Social Club and wasn't that Gotti's Gambino's social club down there?
Oh yeah, the Raven Eyed. Gotti had everybody from all over the Northeast. Everyone in the Gambino family had to go to the Raven Eyed in Little Italy, Mulberry Street. From Connecticut, from far away, you know, and the FBI is staked out down the block and they got video cameras and they still play some of those tapes in court to identify people because they got the entire family on tape practically. Somebody like Michael was there more than once a week. He was there a lot. I mean, because John wanted to physically see everybody. He wanted to be able to observe people, look them in the eye, get a reading on his people, his soldiers, his capos and everything. Yeah, that was just pandemonium, though. If you look at some of the pictures and the videos from back then, these guys with the big Cadillacs were double parked. I mean, Little Italy, the streets are amazingly small down there. I just can't imagine. It just gets so crowded. New York is just the cars. It's gridlock. You can't walk. You can't drive. It's just amazing how many people are stuck together. And you got these well-known gangsters walking among them. That must have been something back in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean,
if you were walking around in Little Italy.
Yeah, if I was a guy trying to find a spot to park and in New York and there's somebody double parked outside of that social club, I'd probably just go ahead and wait. You know what I'm saying? I'd be like, I wouldn't be like honking my horn and going, hey, come on, you going to move that thing? I just... Right, not these guys. They were known who they were.
That whole social club phenomenon. It's everywhere in the United States. We had our own here, and you could drive by, and it'd look exactly like it did in the Ravenite or the Bergen Fish and Hunt Club, and you got a bunch of. We recorded a show on the Rob the Bob kids that were going around robbing those social clubs. So that social club phenomenon is quite a deal.
Yeah, there used to be a lot of them in New York. I mean, it's just literally amazing how many and how densely populated. I don't know, they're supposedly all gone now, but I'm sure there's a few that nobody knows about.
So, Mikey Scars, he got really close with Gotti personally, didn't he? If I remember reading your article, right? I mean, he'd even, you know, go into his house, met his family, and do things like that.
Yeah, John invited him over for New Year's Eve a couple of times, and he said that Gotti did not have a lot of the guys over his house. And Michael thinks that, you know, John thought Michael would be a good somebody good to have around his son, because, you know, his thinking was his son was going to take over for him when he went away or whatever. Because, Gotti must have imagined something would happen to him sooner or later. And Michael was actually... Gotti asked him if he wanted to be consigliere, and that's a major promotion. That's a huge position. Michael didn't really want the job, so he turned it down. And that was kind of the seeds of his downfall, because these other guys Gotti had been in jail by then when he offered Michael the job. And he had the Carozzo brothers. Jojo became consigliere. Then that faction of the family, the Carozzos, basically took power, and they, you know, Michael was not very on it. You know, wasn't on the in with them so much. And that's really, you know, how he wound up doing what he did. That's what I'm saying. Even if you belong to the same family, there's factions in that family, and they want to kill each other. And, you have to be in the right faction. It's really so much of life, even if you're in the mob or if you're not in the mob, so much of life comes down to just luck. It's just things you can't account for.
So where was, speaking to him being, Sammy the Bull ends up being the consigliere, and because he helped with the Polly Castellano hit, so... What was Mikey's what was his position at that time? Did that his relationship with Gotti when Gotti goes from kind of, I guess he was like the underboss to being the boss? Did you ever talk about that?
I know Michael was doing his own thing. I mean, he was an associate. That wasn't really Michael. I mean, Michael wasn't involved with that. I asked him once about, you know, how did you feel when you heard that Paul got killed? Did you know what was happening in the family? And he didn't know what was happening, and he was just really concerned. But a lot of people forget this, but Frank DiCicco was really the major force in that family. He was with Castellano, and he's the one who decided to go with Gotti. That is really, people think Sammy the Bull, but Sammy the Bull was just one of a few guys involved with the hit. They called themselves the Fist at first. There were five of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, Michael wasn't too connected. He wasn't directly involved. But when he realized the people he knew were not upset after Paul was killed, he realized everything was all right.
So yeah, everybody just fell in line then.
Look. Yeah, and when you see the people in power aren't worried, you don't get worried.
So what happened to Mikey at the end? I mean, he caught some kind of a case. What kind of a case?
Well,
he
was indicted for of all things down south. There was a strip club in Georgia, in Atlanta. And he was on trial for that, for shaking down a strip club or a couple of strip clubs. And he won that trial, and he came back to New York. Then Gotti actually died, because one of the last things Michael did was attend Gotti's funeral. And there's actually surveillance footage of him attending the funeral. And after that, he was pinched for the Fred Weiss murder. I believe that was the lead charge in the indictment. And he's in jail, and he finds out he's been shelved by Peter Gotti and Carozzo. And that's really when everything falls apart for him. And the Carozzo brothers take over because, you know, little Nicky was a capo. And so somebody you talked to, Andrew DiDonato, I also spoke with Andrew. He was one of the first guys I think I ever interviewed a few years ago. That's when Nicky Carozzo was supposedly, there was a lot of chatter that he was going to be the boss, and it never happened because then they arrested Carozzo. As soon as they find out you're in line to be the boss or that you're named boss, they kind of focus on you automatically. It's kind of got to be a given that you know that you're going to go down. You have a giant target on your back when you're named boss. I mean, that's even a cliche. Everybody knows that.
Yeah, it's true, too. It is true.
And it happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's in jail and they've nobody's taken care of him and take a deal, I guess.
When he was told that he was shelved, I mean, now that has a tremendous impact on him because he knows exactly what it means. And actually, the person who brought the message to him didn't even know what it meant. They said something about a shelf. I mean, and just being imagine being told that way. He knew instantly what they were saying, but they didn't even know, and it just hit him, the magnitude of it. And he's in jail, he's in prison, he's indicted for murder, and you see the whole, everything is going wrong. It was a really bad time for him. There's a suicide attempt he pulled, but he survived it.
Well, he was in solitary confinement at that time.
Thinking about it now, I get, yeah.
Was he in solitary?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Was he in solitary confinement at that time?
After the suicide attempt, they put him in solitary. I haven't talked to him too much about what happened after that. I mean, I it's not an easy thing to talk about, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I can imagine.
It's like once he commits his mind to doing something, I guess he eventually did it. He was a good witness. He put a lot of guys away and created a lot of room for the next generation to come up.
That's just what I was thinking.
Maybe a little too soon.
Well, they're still going in New York. It seems to me like he went into witness protection, but did he stay in? Most of these guys that I've seen, it's pretty confining, and they have a hard time staying in. They just go ahead and take their chances once they get out. What did he do? What has he done? I know he's done at least one or two interviews out here.
Yeah, Michael was in the program, but he got out. I mean, you mentioned earlier, I think when we were talking, that other interview that Michael did of, I can't think of the podcast, with the Intelligent Talk.
Yeah, Intelligent
from
Talk.
Ralph McElvin. And he said the Marshals, they don't really want you in the program. They just want to play golf.
Yeah, right.
No, they don't really. So I think it's a given that, people eventually get it. They don't give you enough money. They don't make life too comfortable. because they want you to get out. They don't want you to live off them. And, you know, it's, you realize at some point that if you want to get anywhere in life, you're going to have to leave the program and just take life by the horns again. And if you screw up and you commit crimes, you run the same risk of going back to prison, like happened to Sammy the Bull.
Like happened to Sammy the Bull. He just got out again, finally. He's like out and a free man under his original name, I would imagine. He's probably just laying low. I think probably any danger to him is over. What do you think about that? Do you think he's still in any danger?
I don't think so. I mean, unless he makes a lot of noise, going in the media, going on the media, going talking to the newspaper, I doubt he's going to do that. You know, he's in his 70s. He's probably ready to slow down a little. But, I don't think he's in any danger. As long as he just, I wouldn't just stick my head up and yell and make a lot of noise, and I don't think he will. Anyone who wanted to kill him is probably already dead or in prison.
So what's Mikey Scars doing now? Has he got a book? I can't remember. Has he got a book?
He doesn't have one out, but I think he's working on one, or he's talking in talks about one.
Yeah.
I try not to pry into his personal stuff, but I figure he'll tell me when he knows.
I was kind of curious. I had seen that up on the Cosa Nostra News, that post about that interview with Mikey Scars. And what do you think prompted him to come forward and do that podcast interview?
On Intelligent Talk? I don't really know. But I listened to it, and, Michael was in that life for so many years. I mean, decades. He can't, he cannot run out of stories. And I heard so much stuff on that show, that podcast, that I wrote, I got another huge story out of it, all new stuff that he hadn't told me, that he hadn't talked about. And people started asking him all these questions in the comments. And Michael started answering them, using me as the intermediary. I'd call him up, read him the question, and he would tell me the answer, and I would type it into the comment, and I would say, well, Michael said, put it in quotes, and, you have a former Gambino capo asking people, answering people's questions about anything about the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not an opportunity you get often.
No, not at all.
Really, yeah, it was great.
Well, and if you happen to talk with him, let him know that we would love to talk with him.
If he wants to do another podcast interview, we'd happy to do.
I will.
Be happy to do a phoner with him. I like listening
sure.
to him. He's a good, solid guy. I like those good, solid guys. He's not what I call, the word I use is wormy. He's not a wormy dude. He's a stand-up, good, solid guy and answers straight up.
If he doesn't know, he'll just tell you, I don't know.
yeah. Folks out there, you need to go to the Cosa Nostra News and read this interview and then read all the comments down below. You just heard why. And a lot of interesting stuff, more than we have time to go into on this podcast.
And then go out and listen to that interview that he did.
There's a link.
I hate to plug another podcaster.
Well,
but
a rising tide floats all boats, I say. So that's Intelligent Talk.
Absolutely.
And there's a link to it from Ed's article, so I'd highly recommend you do that. There's only one other thing I want to talk about, and then we'll wind this on down, Ed. We've been here quite a while. A subject near and dear to my heart, and that was a New York City police officer and his partner were following a mob guy. I can't even remember what family he was from, but he was a gambler, Federico Fritzi Giovanelli, back in 1986. And they're just like trailing along behind him, and they think they were burnt. And they go on, they see him pull in to get some coffee or something, or they drive on by him, and then they pull over to get some coffee, and then they see him coming back that way and parking really close to where they were. And the male officer, Anthony Venditti, walked in to get some coffee, and his partner was a female, Kathleen Burke, and she said, he just pulled up in this area. And the guy said, yeah, don't worry about it. Just wait here. I'm running and get some coffee, thinking that there's no way, no way that you should be in any danger from a mob guy when you're a policeman. And you know, I followed many of these guys, and I felt the same thing. But something happened. He ended up getting killed. What do you remember about that story there? You live in New York, and it was really created a big stir in the new NYPD, and I'm sure in the news and the media. I know they went after him with everything that they had. What do you remember about that one, Ed?
He was with the Genovese family, and I remember hearing about it back in the 80s. I mean, it was just shocking because he would, like, the mob guys don't kill cops. It was such a brutal execution. I think he was shot 9 times or 8 times, the two cops, the Venditti and Burke.
Yeah, they ended up shooting. They ended up shooting a female. So I think she jumped out of the car and ran up to the scene, and they popped her. She ran up, by the way. I understood that. Go ahead.
Yeah, she got it in the chest. I mean, so she was definitely looking at them, heading toward them. And she swears it was Fritzy Giovanelli and two other guys. But some of the guys I've talked to, my sources, they claim that Giovanelli had nothing to do with the shooting, that it wasn't him. And I don't know. I mean, but they swear that Fritzy was not the kind of guy to shoot a cop. I mean, you know, they sound pretty convincing, and they really, you know, they're not telling me for a story. They're expressing a personal opinion, and they don't think he did it. I, you know, are they defending him? Maybe, just always possible. But my take is they really don't think he did it. And if he didn't do it, who did it? You know, it's interesting. Why couldn't they put him away? They tried him 3 times, 4 times. They got him for racketeering, and that was overturned. So there was something wrong with that trial, with the Kathleen Burke's testimony. It wasn't enough. They couldn't find anything to corroborate it. I don't know. There's a lot of gossip about that, a lot of different theories. But they never got him for it.
Well, here's the theory. Is it possible, if of all the various murders that may occur in New York City, when it's a cop, those are definitely the crimes they want to solve?
Oh, more than anything else. I can't think of anything else they'd want to solve as much. I mean, if you kill a cop, I mean, you've got every cop, every detective, every security guard. I mean, anyone in law enforcement or connected, understandably, is coming after you. You know, that was the gentleman's agreement between the mob and the law. You know, you don't go after someone's family, they don't go after you. You know, there's certain rules. And back in the 80s, everything was violent and crazy enough where I think everyone believed it entirely possible that there weren't any rules anymore. You know, aside from the mob, you had crack, you know, drive-by shootings. You had so much crazy stuff going on. It's such an incredibly violent decade. And I remember living through that, reading the papers and the headlines and the news, all the shootings and all the murders. It's just incredible. Today, it's New York City's like Disneyland compared to then.
Well, I know. I was going to say that as a thought. Even though Eric served in the 70s and the 80s, into the 90s, he would tell an anecdotal story I'd recollect of following somebody, and they were onto the tail, and he pulls into a parking lot, and they pull their following behind him, and he kind of lays down on the seat as they circle around him in the parking lot.
Yeah, just to let me know that they knew that I was following him, that he goes on.
Yeah.
And I had another time that they spotted me, and I saw him running, get in their car. It was in a used car lot, and I saw him, like, pointing up my way, and then two of them ran and jumped in the car, so I backed out and took off, and man, they were on my tail, and I made a few blocks, and they just stayed right on my tail. And they couldn't, the traffic was such they couldn't get next to me. So I got to a red light, and I pulled up and stopped, and they were right behind me. And I just drove on through the red light, and they didn't have enough guts to drive through the red light. So, but here's the problem, and here's what I wonder might have happened that night. The problem is, did they think? Did Giovitelli, and then he maybe saw them following him. They'd been following him earlier. did he maybe stop and call some help and say, you know, I think I'm being followed. Somebody's going to, you know, they're trying to rob me, or maybe I've been set up for a hit. And then somehow, you know, his guys show up and they end up in a confrontation. And these, I know how we dressed, and I'm sure they dressed like we dressed when we were following these dudes around. We dressed just like anybody on the street would try to even dress a little bit like them with, you know, slacks and a snap brim hat and a windbreaker or something.
Yeah, you didn't have a hat on, a police uniform or a badge no. showing.
And the woman would have been dressed kind of slovenly the same way, Lord, because she could fit in on the street. So, you know, who knows? He might have thought that
makes
were trying to rob
a lot
him.
Of sense. That, yeah, that really fits. I mean, that's a good theory, because especially if they were younger guys who are looking to make a name for themselves, they're not going to think twice about taking out a couple of crooks. If they think they're crooks, they don't even know they're cops.
Protecting the boss. Oh, yeah.
I would say that's possible, yeah.
Heck yeah. I mean, I could see it.
How many years did you...
No, I did that for...
I wanted to ask you about...
I did that for 13 years, following people around and...
And who did you work for exactly? The state police?
No, the Kansas City Police. Kansas City, Missouri Police. It's kind of the big duck on the western side of the state. And we had our own mob family, the Civella family, with about, you know, it's really funny. I did a table of organization with their pictures, and I had one of Chicago, and I put it right next to one of Kansas City, and we look pretty anemic compared to Chicago. They've got like six crews and, a boss and a couple of underbosses, really, and then we've got one boss, one consigliere, and one underboss, and then a whole bunch, about four or five, eight guys, maybe, and that was the extent of the made guys in Kansas City. We actually even got a list of the made guys once, and it was only like 12 or 15, and four of them were older than dirt, so they weren't doing anything anymore. But, you know, we had a lot of active associates. We had a bunch of active associates, and we had a real mob. During those times, we had a mob war, I stumbled in the middle of one of the hits almost, and then they spotted me, and they saw me. And,
oh, wow.
You know, and they see there's three guys in the car cruising around a guy that they want to hit, and he's by himself in a bar. And so I start moving in. I see what's going on, and I move in, and I don't recognize this car. It's not one of their normal cars. It's just this ubiquitous kind of plain Jane vanilla wrapper Chevy. And there's the Tuffy DeLuna, the underboss. He's sitting in the right front, and I kind of move in close, and I get stuck at a traffic light, and they're right next to me. And I look over, and Tuffy's just like giving me this kind of stare. And then I glance over, and he just kind of gives me a little grin, and they take a left, and they keep on going. So, so it, you know, it's always out there. It's a dangerous world to prowl around in, and it's not everybody needs to know who the players are. You need to have a scorecard to know who the players are. You can get hurt, that's for sure. Go ahead, Aaron. You got a question?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I was reading this in terms of the timeline in the 80s, 84. You know, the other side of this might be when we talked about that couple that were robbing the social clubs.
Oh, yeah, they were doing that during that time, weren't
they? Wasn't that in the same kind of time frame?
It was.
So I could see where they might be a little more jumpy.
It was the early 90s.
It was like 1990, 91. They said Gotti actually gave the order to hit him because they robbed his, I think it was the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club, or maybe it was Ravenite, robbed it twice. It was pretty embarrassing.
They robbed a lot of clubs, and they did hit one at least two or three times. I think it was a Gambino club, but the Bananos tried to say that their guys did it too. They were actually fighting over credit for a while.
Yeah, on who did the hit? I read that. I think that one of the Gottis, younger Gottis, was claiming somebody else was claiming, and Gotti said, no, we did that.
Yeah, the fact that they were driving around in the neighborhood like on their day off. Yeah. You know, unless they were, you know, scoping out some more social clubs to rob, would just make no sense at all. Like, same car.
Well, they lived in the
same
neighborhood.
MO. Yeah,
they
I know.
They never changed cars, and they lived in the neighborhood. I don't know how they got away with it as long as they did. Do
right.
you, Ed?
They weren't master criminals.
They were not master criminals. That's a good way to put it.
You rob social clubs over and over again. You're going to get killed unless you go to Mexico.
Yeah.
You don't stay in Queens or wherever you're.
Really, Bensonhurst. I think they lived in Bensonhurst.
Wasn't it?
And, I think so.
I think, you know, it might have been in part just because they, of course, robbed them at the social clubs. But the other part had to be they were going to exact revenge because they made them drop their pants.
Yeah.
It's kind of a humiliation factor. Get them to stack on top of each other and hump the guy on the bottom. You know that guy's going to even the score.
I read somebody wrote a piece about it, and they said that you've heard of the term suicide by cop, which is a real deal. That happens a lot.
Yeah.
But this was suicide by mob. It's like they wanted to commit suicide, yeah. and they knew that the mob would do it. Might as well have a little fun on the way.
And supposedly the wise guys said that despite how upset or angry or furious they were, after one of the robberies, they were like, the girl drove, and the guy would run in with the Uzi and steal the wallets.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, wow, she's a pretty good getaway driver.
They had certain admiration.
Her on her driving skills.
You might have to bring her around to the social club.
Get away with all their money.
Well, interesting. All right. Well, Ed, this has been great. We've had a good time. I really appreciate you calling in and doing this. We will I'll let you know when we get this put up, the New York Mob Month.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. This was the first pod, maybe the only pod that I've ever done. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on the program.
I look forward to listening to it.
Yeah. You know, Ed, we're about the only kind of mob-only podcast out there. There's another guy, and I think he's out of New York, Mob Talk, I think, Mob Talk Radio or something like that. He does them, but he's kind of, I seem like there for a while, he was kind of sporadic. I kind of monitored his progression and where his stories were, so there wouldn't be a lot of, I wouldn't have the same story he did. And he was mainly focusing on the northeast part of the United States, and I've been mainly focusing on the Midwest and the West. So, but there's no other, solely mob oriented podcast out there other than myself and him, it seems to me like.
No, absolutely not.
Few people maybe have it as a subject once in a while because they'll have somebody that's got a book out, but then between the next three, they'll have a cookbook or, they'll have something totally off the subject. So we're going to keep it going.
Exactly.
We like doing it. We got a lot of friends in Chicago, and one guy even mailed us a City of Chicago flag. We have done so many Chicago outfit stories, so we have the City of Chicago flag. So we're going to move around the country a little bit and do New York and Las Vegas and I'm going to do L.A. I got to do some L.A. stories. I did one, and we got a huge pop out of L.A. after I did that one. So I need to do like a whole L.A. mob month.
Yeah, people are interested in the L.A. family, the West Coast families, Lanza. I mean, Lanza, there's a lot of interest. You should hit as many of those as you can, if you ask me.
And Jimmy,
I'd be glad to help you.
Oh, good. I'll be in touch.
I was going to say, I'd be glad to help you.
Fratiano's got, he was an L.A. guy. I talked about him, and the story I did was about a murder that happened in the 50s, and he's the one that did the murder, and he ended up talking about it when he came in. And so he's got some L.A. stories, and San Diego, the whole Southern California thing, and then there's the guy that was connected to Spilotro was in Vegas, and they called it the Mickey Mouse Mob there for a while. There's a pretty good story about him. All of a sudden, I've lost his name, but anyhow, there's 7 million stories in the Naked City, and these are just a few of them. We'll keep telling them what we had.
Exactly, and the well never runs dry when it's the American Cosa Nostra.
It does not. All right, Ed, thanks a lot. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
All right. Sure. Anytime. Thanks a lot.
Right.
Take care.
Well, folks, I definitely need to go out and follow him on CosaNostraNews.com as well as the Twitter, Cosa Nostra News. And he's on Twitter himself personally with Ed Scarpo.
Yeah, he's a good guy, and he's a prolific writer. He's a good writer.
He's a prophylactic writer.
Prophylactic writer. Yeah, you would go there, wouldn't you? Prolific. That's a $25. I like using those $25 words. I don't know if you folks noticed that or not, but I like using big words once in a while. I get my dollars worth out of my 3 years in law school and my 25 cents worth, whatever you want to say. Anyhow, that was I want to learn more about this New York Mafia. I tell you, after interviewing Andrew DiDonato, he gave me an appetite for it, and I'm going to continue to go. And next week, folks, we're going to have the author of Divorce from the Mob, My Journey from Organized Crime to Independent Woman, Andrea Giovino. She was married to two different mob guys. They were drug dealers. She was Italian. Both of her husbands were Peckerwoods, Aaron. So she married outside. One of them was even an Irishman. But she has a heck of a story. So
and then doesn't she have a daughter who's on a...
Oh, yeah, her daughter, Hogarty's, her last husband, her second husband, the mother of her daughter was named Hogarty. He was an Irishman, and her name was Bridget Hogarty. And she was on Mob Wives. She had a big to-do, I think, with Karen Gravano, I believe. You know, they had Karen Gravano, Sammy Gravano's daughter on there, and there was always like this problem about, because he was a rat by then, you know, in the mm-hmm. parlance and in their language. What's interesting is people outside the mob, I noticed on Facebook, they call people rats, and they think they're a rat. But, you know, in all those wiretaps that I've got, they never use the word rat. They use the word stoolie. Or stool pigeon, kind of an old-time term. Maybe modern times they call them rats, but back in the day, the real deal mob guys called them stoolies. So
so somehow that didn't count, and she shouldn't be on the real Mob Wives show. Because
no, it did count. It did count. It counted big time because she had paid her dues. But the problem was they would denigrate her father because he was a rat.
Yeah.
And so it would create... tension, shall we say. It created drama on the show.
Well, maybe they wanted that because, you know.
Exactly. That's my point.
That would make it an interesting show. But,
much
you know,
more.
We've talked to a number of these alleged rats, and I would have to say that those firsthand accounts are the most credible thing you could possibly bring forward. And by all means, if you happen to be one of those people and you've listened to the Gangland Wire and you're not a rat, you're not a stoolie, but you're working for an organized crime family, we'd be interested in talking to you.
Yeah. Give us a call.
Send us an email, ganglandwire@gmail.com.
Yeah, there you go. All right, Aaron, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase on Amazon. And after you're done watching that, you're going to want to know more. And there is more, because you can get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, because there is more, Gary has a new book out, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
You will read the printed words from the mouth of the men that did it. And then you're going to want to get the Kindle version, because you can hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it as actual links in the Kindle book version with video transcriptions, so you can understand what the hell they're saying.
You got to have the explanation, that's for sure. And I will provide the explanation. Aaron, speaking of that, I had a guy making some nasty comments on my, I think it was on the YouTube page, about a little piece of the audio of Carl Tuffy DeLuna talking mm-hmm. to Spilotro. And the main reason I put it up, I didn't even know enough how to explain what they were talking about for the most part, because there was some problem. And Tony said, hey, you know, I don't like that. I ain't a scam guy. And then the main reason I put it up is that Tuffy said something about his Magari, and she was out there, and Tony says, Spilotro says, huh? And he says, oh, I forgot, you don't speak Italian, do you? So it's just kind of that, I like that little human interaction between the mob guys. So this guy put up this long diatribe about how, was trying to say that Tony Spilotro was some kind of a scam guy, and, you know, he was a real deal mob. I don't know what all it was, but, you know, people are funny. They, when they look at this stuff, they try to make sense out of it. And many times you can't make sense out of it unless you know all the context. And then when you know all the context, sometimes you can't make sense out of it.
You know as much of the context as anybody, and it.
And I still didn't know that one.
And it still can be confusing.
If you'd have been at the trial when they played it, you would have known anyhow. All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.